are listening to KBOO Portland.
By the mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tune in to KBOO Monday mornings at 9 for the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for radically democratic news, views, reviews, and interviews, stories of ordinary and extraordinary people working to root down the oppressive institutions of capitalism. That's the Old Mole Variety Hour, Monday mornings at 9.
There's something missing in the litting. I got something to say. Oh, yeah.
Good evening. You're listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. And today we're talking with Maeve, Rain, Mac, and Finn from actors from the Cascadia Creative Conservatory, as well as playwright Maeve O'Connor, about their upcoming productions. They have two performances coming up this upcoming weekend in Salem. And we just wanted to talk to them about their performances, hear from the playwright, hear from some of the actors, and find out what's going on. Maeve, Rain, Mac, and Finn, welcome to Transpositive.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks. So let's all go around first, and if you can introduce yourselves, we'll start with Maeve and just kind of go around the room. And if you could introduce yourselves, tell us what your role is in these theater productions, and also if you feel like it, please share your preferred pronouns.
So my name is Maeve Z. O'Connor. I am a playwright and performer, but predominantly a playwright, and I'm really honored to be the season playwright for this season of Cascadia Creative Conservatory. I wrote Omission and The Icarus Paradox, and I'm really, really excited to see them both on stage. And my pronouns are she, they.
And my name is Rain Holland. I use he, they pronouns, and I'm playing Monet in The Icarus Paradox.
I'm Finn Mendez. I use he, they pronouns, and I'm playing Felix in The Icarus Paradox.
I am Mac Karcher. I use they, them pronouns, and I'm playing Rue in Omission.
Great. So we have two theatrical productions. Let's get the details in right away, Maeve, and tell us where are these being performed and when. Give us all the details.
Absolutely. So both of these shows are being produced as part of CCC, Cascadia Creative Conservatory, which currently operates out of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Salem. We ourselves are not a religiously affiliated organization, but we're very lucky to be hosted by an inclusive church that follows a doctrine of social justice, and they have a dedicated social justice team that is part of organizing us and our marketing and our protocols and our best practices. So that's been really cool. You can see the shows this coming weekend. There's a Friday performance, there's a Saturday performance, and then we're done. We're wrapped for the summer. So catch us before we go.
Great. So Maeve, tell us a little bit about...
So The Icarus Paradox was inspired really heavily for me by neo-futurism and absurdism. And I wrote it, honestly, more than anything about the feeling of being stuck. And our producing director, Lorianne Schmidt, chose these two plays, not because they are super similar in plot or tone, but because they share the similar theme of claustrophobia and feeling stuck and feeling really bound to your circumstances. And I've just made it sound really terribly serious and not fun at all. And The Icarus Paradox is, more than anything, I think one of the funnest things I have ever written. It is strange. It is odd. It takes its beats alternately very unseriously and very honestly and poignantly, I hope. It plays with language a lot. And in terms of an actual concrete plot, it follows a group of people who experience a glitch or a fault in reality, and they end up in this liminal space called the Summer House that they cannot leave. And they must contend with both their circumstances and with each other.
Sounds a little bit like Waiting for Godot.
Oh, I will absolutely take that. Thank you.
Rain, what is your role in the Icarus Paradox?
I'm playing Monet, who is an artist, but no relation to Claude Monet. They find themselves in the Summer House after a long while of traveling in the multiverse. They are a free, kind of free-spirited, romantic, artistic character who is not originally specifically written to be genderqueer, but they are.
I will say we have never, in all of the different workshops and productions of this that we've done, we've never cast a cis Monet. It's simply never happened. So at this point.
Thanks. Yeah. And Finn, what about you? What is your role in the Icarus Paradox?
I play Felix, who is like a teenage boy who is really at a war with his own head because he's dealing with a physical manifestation of a lot of mental troubles that she basically dragged him into the Summer House, and now he's stuck there, presumably after quite a lot of multidimensional hopping.
And let's talk about the other play, Omission. Maeve, again, if you can, please tell us about Omission.
Yeah, so Omission is a really tight 4.5 character drama, because there's sort of a surprise character nearer to the end. It follows, I don't know if I already gave you the summary on our actual recording, but it follows a professor in search of her missing wife. She gets trapped in a jazz bar during a terrible storm. Again, another really liminal space, another really like out of time, out of sync, out of place type of story. And this Professor Rue, played by Mac, who's here with us, must interact with these other patrons also stuck in this bar. And they find themselves at great and terrible odds. Their getting to know you games get darker and darker and weirder. And it builds into what I think, especially as Mac is acting it, is a really frightening conclusion, which I won't spoil for you.
It reminds me a little bit of the plot for the Grand Royale from Star Trek The Next Generation. I don't know if you ever saw that one. Very similar. Anyways, Mac, tell me, what is your role in Omission?
I am the aforementioned Professor Rue. I enter looking for my wife and find instead several other patrons of the bar that are rather rude to me, I might say. I kind of view Rue as just desperately fighting for some semblance of control and just constantly desperately searching for her wife. And again, it ends in a rather frightening conclusion.
So Maeve, how do you incorporate themes of gender queerness, trans, non-binary, gender fluid identities into your work? Is it an element in your craft?
Absolutely. Something that's really important to me, and something that I've noticed in theater, is there are so many roles that really don't have to be gender specific, right? Like there are characters in endless shows that I've seen or read that truly could be played by anybody of any gender or any gender presentation, a character that could be trans, could be fluid, could be NB, could be anything, but in their character breakdown, it's no, cis female, or no, this is a man. And, you know, then I'll read the play and I'll go, but it doesn't matter. You're not talking about a theme that requires that character to be a man, or you're not setting the story up in such a way that that character couldn't be trans or couldn't be played by a trans actor. And so as a playwright, I feel like, I mean, especially as a queer playwright, it's my responsibility to create those opportunities for our whole community, not just for the cis gays. And so you have characters like Monet, who in my character breakdown is noted as any gender, doesn't matter, any gender presentation. And then you have characters that I would prefer to be played by a trans actor because of the layers of meaning it adds. So Felix in the Icarus Paradox. And then I have some explicitly trans characters, although there are none in either of these shows.
Rain, how do you interpret the role of Monet? Do you take it and make it into a queer character? Is it already written as a queer character?
Yeah, there's some mentions like within the script of them not having the name that they started with, that they picked out the name Monet because it felt right and it felt better than what they had before. And they have a lot of themes of being able to change their own circumstance as they've needed to. And I really see that as a really beautiful kind of queer allegory. They have this romantic plot line that reads less queer now that I am more now that I pass more as a man in real life. But we've done a few workshops a few years back. This character's been with me since I was like 14 years old, and has gotten to transition with me. And I think they're really, really important to me as a trans character who doesn't have to like struggle with transness, who is just a character who has changed their name because they needed to, and who has gotten out of their original universe because they needed to, and is happy with their gender and everything because they've gotten to that place of self-acceptance in their life.
So you have a relationship with this character going back many years.
Yes. Yeah, we did a couple workshops for it, one over Zoom in 2020 and one in 2021. And I believe I'm the only acting crossover from those two workshops to this performance. And I feel really, really lucky about that. Monet's really important to me as a character, and for the past 5 years of my life.
I just saw Monet's Water Lilies up at the Institute of Art like last week. Is this related to Claude Monet, or is this a different Monet?
Just a different Monet. Someone who also paints and also loves water and all of that, but is not Claude Monet. And
oh, got it. Okay.
Particularly related.
Finn, what about your character? How do you interpret your character? Do you draw on queerness in any way in the interpretation or projection of your character?
Absolutely. The thing about Felix, as Maeve mentioned beforehand, is that Felix is not explicitly trans or implied to be, really, but when played by a trans actor, there's a lot of layers that come to surface, and a lot of context, I think, is built upon, especially since Felix is a character that is struggling a lot with mental health struggles. And as, you know, a young trans person who has also dealt with depression and anxiety, it becomes especially poignant to have that character played by a trans person. The physical manifestation of a lot of his mental health issues is another character named Apate, and she is supposed to be a little girl. And as a trans person, it's been very easy to read that as also an embodiment of gender dysphoria. Apate is a character that is constantly berating and belittling Felix throughout the show. And I think that it's just very, very, very telling that she is a little girl and he's a boy. So you know, to play Felix, there's a lot that resonates there.
Thank you. And Mac, I'll ask you the same question about your character in Omission. Is your character queer? Do you bring the lens of queerness in any way to the interpretation of your character in Omission?
Yes. Rue is inherently queer as she's married to a woman. The character herself doesn't necessarily read as trans, but she possibly could. I know that she uses exclusively she, her pronouns, but yeah, I don't know. She might be a lesbian. She might be bisexual. I personally interpret her as a lesbian. Oh, wait, no, it does explicitly say she's a lesbian in the script. I'm stupid. But
in her character.
Yes, I do. Do you mind if I say the line, Maeve? One of my favorite lines in the script is Rue speaking to Eddie, another character, after he asks who she is, if he knows her. And Rue says, "I am a lesbian and you are a child." And A, that's kind of homosexual. And B, that's definitely my favorite line in the script.
It sounds like you all have known each other for a while. Is that true? Have you known each other for a bit?
I've known Maeve for about a year now. I met her last summer during another show. But yeah, it's been lovely getting to know this group of people around Salem. It's been very healing for me.
Yeah, I've known Finn for I guess a little less than a year then. And then Mac for maybe 2.5 years. And Maeve, I have known since I was about 12 years old.
Okay.
Rain and I go so there's all the way back to childhood. And then the other two I've picked up along the way in a couple of recent years.
Oh, great. So a whole range of years of getting to know each other and working with each other. When did you all start working together doing theater specifically?
I met just about everyone here through theater and or through acting, at least. It's I think the basis for I think all my relationships with the people here is the origin of them is theater.
Great. Are you all located in Salem?
I'm from Kaiser, so just outside of Salem, but yes.
Definitely the valley. I bounce up to Portland sometimes since I have some family there that I'm able to stay with. I'm very lucky in that regard. But I'm based out of Salem. Most of my work comes out of here and stays around here.
And what's it like? I mean, what is support for the arts like in Salem?
It's interesting. We have a very strong local scene in terms of we have some local theaters that put on very consistent work, very regular work. There are just some fascinating like projects and some fascinating minds hanging out in the valley that I think are very commonly overlooked. That being said, I am kind of sometimes surprised by how little community there is very specifically for queer actors, queer art. It's interesting for me to see, you know, we are doing shows that we put queer people into. We're not necessarily doing queer shows. We're not necessarily doing shows by queer playwrights. And so being able to do this summer has been really, really special.
What about? Do you feel supported as queer people in Salem? Is the support for the LGBTQ2IAS+ community, is it strong in Salem? How does that feel growing up queer in Salem?
I think there's a bit of a strong mix of sides in Salem where generally it's I feel supported, but there is a very large percentage of very conservative people. It's kind of a confusing contrast because it is a really kind of red area. But I am very supported and I am like able to be out and proud at work, and I'm able to like be in really in really good queer groups in Salem.
At least, you know, downtown, and when I'm actually in the city proper, as long as I'm not, you know, out messing around in farmland for some reason or on my way to somewhere nearby, I feel like safe holding my girlfriend's hand on the street. Generally speaking, like I have never been harassed in Salem, which is more than I can say of the whole country. But yeah, it's definitely not the, you know, like perfect blue Shangri-La.
What about Kaiser? Is it about the same in Kaiser, fan? I mean, do you feel pretty comfortable in Kaiser growing up queer, being queer?
I think I'm overall, yes. I was very fortunate to have a lot of adults in my life that were very accepting. Going to public school also was a little interesting because Kaiser is outside of Salem and is definitely a little bit more more rural, I guess. I think my experience in like high school theater was overall very positive. I loved doing theater in high school, and also there definitely felt like there was a lack of strong queer representation and strong queer community within my high school and also within my drama spaces. So going into this company has been really nice.
Oh, great. Would you care to answer that question, Mac? Do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I am freshly new to Salem, but I spent most of my life in California, Central Valley, which was not the most accepting place. So I'm very happy to be in Oregon, surrounded by queer friends and queer community.
Maeve, tell us again, we're talking with Maeve, Rain, Mac, and Finn about two performances that are happening this weekend upcoming, Paradox and Omission. Maeve, tell us again about these plays. Where are they being performed and when? How can people find out about them?
You can catch the Icarus Paradox and Omission at Cascadia Creative Conservatory, which operates out of the UU congregation in Salem. We are very lucky to be working directly with their social justice team and under their umbrella of acceptance. And this is our closing weekend that is upcoming. So we have one more weekend, Friday, Saturday, and then we're done for the summer.
Thanks. And what kind of a reception are you getting for the performances?
So as of right now, we actually haven't opened yet. We open tonight. fingers crossed.
Oh my goodness.
Thus far, just in terms of like the buzz that we're generating around the shows, I am hearing really good things and people getting excited and people getting intrigued, especially people our age and especially queer people of all ages. I mean, especially now with the state of things and the state of the world being what it is. Forgive me for any self-importance, but we need stuff like this. Like, we need an opportunity to get together and watch stories where we don't just all die at the end, you know?
Any chance you'd workshop these performances up in Portland for, say, the TBA Festival next year, or maybe for Fertile Ground coming up this winter?
I would be really honored for an opportunity to take either of these shows farther. I have actually had a show in Fertile Ground before, although it was neither of these ones. It was Leaving Manzanita. It was actually my first fully staged full-length play. I was, oh gosh, I think 16 when it was accepted and then 17 when it was actually produced and performed. So I've worked with Fertile Ground in the past, and they're just amazing. PDX Playwrights is such a fantastic institution.
I just came from the Fringe Festival. I was back in the Midwest to see family, and we caught some of the Fringe Festival, and I was amazed at how many of the performances in the Fringe Festival featured queer, trans voices. Can you talk about what role small independent theater plays in giving voice to marginalized communities?
I want to hear from you three on this one. Because it's, you know, I mean, I can sit here and wax poetic about the writing of the stuff all day, but at the end of the day, none of the writing matters if actors don't show up and do it.
Yeah, I think having having small independent theater where there's like lower barriers to participation is really important for actors and for young actors and for people who haven't acted a lot because maybe because they're queer and they haven't like had that sort of space to be themselves before. I think having small local low barriers to entry is really important for that, and I think low barriers for entry for audiences for something small like this that like doesn't cost as much as like a big professional production makes it easier for people to see it. It makes it easier for people to experience theater and queer theater and see themselves in theater, and I think that's really important.
I mentioned that doing high school theater, it was a little bit hard with having queer representation on stage, and that that's just true. It's hard because you're doing shows that are not built for queer casts. It is so easy to, as a young person, especially a young queer person, to go into the theater world and feel like you're the exception, like things need to be moved in order to make space for you. Roles need to be changed in order for it to be acceptable for you to play them. And so to have have the conservatory, which is so tailor-made for the queer experience, which is putting on works that are made for queer people, it is just so incredibly healing. And I'm really, really excited for this generation of young queer and trans people to be able to experience theater that is built for them and a space that is just so, so welcoming. I think that I'm very optimistic about that.
That's another reason why I love our director, Lorianne Schmidt, so much. It's because a lot of directors out there will straight up not cast you if you are visibly trans or queer. They will just outright say no and cast the cis actor standing next to you. Not just because they're a better actor, but because they're cis and passing. Lorianne Schmidt has created such a wonderful space for queer youth. She helps mentor them, she guides them, and she gives them excellent roles. And I think that's so important. CCC really feels so welcoming and so open to everyone. And it's been wonderful.
At this moment, the trans and queer community are specifically being targeted by the current administration. And one of the first targets that they've gone after is support for the arts. Can you talk about how this has affected you personally and what you see people doing to resist this attack on the arts and on queer representation in the arts?
I'll tell you just from a very concrete, you know, sort of first whistle that you notice before the oncoming storm. You know, I think when you're in these theatrical and these artistic spaces, there's an assumption that otherness is just acceptable, that it's okay. But as Mac just said, that's not always true. You know, there's this like facade of, well, it's the arts, so everyone is welcome. Well, you know, it's the arts. It's sort of built on the backs of queer people, of queer writers, of queer composers. But we don't want to cast you if you're too trans. We don't want to cast you if you're too gender nonconforming. We don't want to cast you if your voice doesn't match your face, quote unquote, which is something I've actually heard, which is so far out of the realm of acceptable. But at the very least, you would see this facade of like, yes, we are, you know, an inclusive submission portal. We are an inclusive theater company. We want submissions from queer playwrights. But then you look at their season and they're not producing the submissions from queer playwrights. And so what the first thing that I noticed is the facade itself just crumbles, and it's been crumbling, but it's especially now been crumbling this year. Like I am, you know, constantly submitting and resubmitting plays and play proposals and pitches and draft notes, just everywhere you can, because that's the hustle. And I'm finding fewer and fewer opportunities that are willing to even give me a call back. There are a lot of places that see that I've noted that, oh, this character is trans, or see that I've noted, oh, these characters can be played by anyone of any gender, or they see that I've noted, hey, I mean, here's omission, here's a story about a queer woman, period. Like, she is the main character. And like, that's it for them. They're just like, oh, well, we would like to do this, but it's not safe to do it right now. And I feel like that's so backwards, right? Like, no, we especially need to be doing this right now. As someone told me once, if we stop celebrating, they win. While you think on that, I do want to again shout out our director, Lorianne Schmidt. None of this is possible without her. She is such a just magical, encouraging presence. She shows up every single day, like ready to do anything that needs to be done. If lights need programming, she programs them. If an actor needs comforting, she comforts them. She sits down and she dissects my work and my dialogue in a way that is like just so beautiful to see from a straight person. Like, to know that we're supported not just in our community and by other members of our community, but by allies and by strong supporters outside of it. So we're just very lucky to have her, and I want to shout her out.
So I just wanted to thank you all again for joining us today on Transpositive. Maeve, if you could just tell us one more time, tell us about when the shows are playing and any contact information.
Yes. So by the time that this airs, we will have one more weekend for you to catch us, Friday, Saturday, at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Salem. You can find us online by looking up Unitarian Universalist Salem and then following the, you know, link tree to CCC. You can also find us on Instagram. Gosh, we have a newly made
Cascadia Creative Conservatory.
Great. Maeve, Rain, Mac, and Finn, thank you so much for joining us tonight on Transpositive.
Good evening and welcome to Transpositive, the podcast. We have several topics tonight, so let's go around and introduce ourselves. I'm Nicolette and I use they, them pronouns.
My name's Emma and I use she and her pronouns.
Sheila, she, her pronouns.
Great. So which topic do we want to start with first?
Well, let's start by talking about the Olympics. So apparently the National Olympic Committee has, the U.S. has said that it will no longer allow transgender athletes to compete in the World Olympics. So this was an announcement from the United States. Trump says that he's going to quote unquote test transgender athletes to prevent them from competing in both the Olympic and the Paralympic Games. It seems like he's mostly interested in transgender women, kind of going on his normal obsession with transgender women, which...
Of course, that doesn't change the Olympic. The Olympic Committee's rules, does it, for other countries?
Right. And that's a good point. So one of the things that transgender women can do is they can just go to a country that supports transgender women and say, hey, I'd like to, you know, compete for your country.
Like, they could also do like the Russians, where the Russians had that problem. Remember, the Russians were barred because of drug testing, and then they were able to set up a neutral kind of a zone or something like that where they were competing as individuals, not representing any specific country. There might be something about that.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, to my knowledge, only one openly transgender athlete has ever actually competed in the Olympics. And that was you know, that person did really do really well. I mean, it was great that they competed, but it didn't really make a big difference in the outcome of the games. So I don't know, what are your thoughts about that?
Mine?
I mean, I'm wondering what he means by like the testing he plans to implement, because I mean, already the basic testing that's involved is just like hormone testing. So what I'm wondering is, what is he suggesting? Is he talking about genital checks? Like, is that what they're trying to do here? I'm just very confused about this, and I'm wondering, what exactly do you think you're going to prevent by not allowing trans athletes to compete? Because I thought their whole concern was they believe that trans women have some sort of biological advantage, but we know that once they undergo hormone therapy, they don't. So it just seems absurd to me, and I don't understand what he thinks he's going to accomplish, and I don't know exactly what his plan is.
Yeah.
What I expect will happen is that transgender people might be given the option to qualify if they can meet the criteria for the and compete as males, but I don't think, for instance, I'm thinking about diving. Diving is the same whether you're male or female, and there's no inherent advantage to one or the other. So to say that you can't compete because you're naturally a better diver because you're a male would be absolutely absurd. In fact, a woman might even spin faster and actually have an innate advantage. But what you have to remember is that this is his signature moves, is in which he acts out continually when he has one of his little rallies. He pretends that he's some sort of heavy, heavy weightlifter, and he has a pretending to be female. He has this thing like he's trying to lift this very, very heavy barbell, like it's so hard to do and impossible to do. And the crowd, of course, laughs and thinks this is immensely funny. And then he has, now comes the transgender athlete, and he just, just pushes the bar up with no trouble at all. And he does the same thing with all kinds of sports. This is one of his signature moves. It's all designed with the idea. It has a massive appeal on the idea that that gender is immutable, and it also fits a perfect fit for his narrative, which is that schools are trying to take your children away. And you go to school one day as a male and you pop back the next day all healed and everything, and now you're a female. And that's how he presents it, that this is sort of an eye blink procedure. And that's, of course, gets huge play. And it's one of the reasons he's getting rid of the Department of Education, because he says we want to return control to the states and to the families, and not forgetting that the primary function of the federal Department of Education is actually to give money to rural schools that can't possibly survive without that help. So the whole thing is absurd, but his whole mindset and the whole thing that he portrays in everyday life is to attack education, to attack professional standards, to invalidate medical opinions, and then to make that normative for Americans, and in other words, to appeal to the lowest common denominator of American prejudice and innate hatreds and misunderstanding of transgender people.
Go ahead, sorry.
There does seem to be a lot of misinformation about what's actually happening with trans athletes and trans kids. You know, like you mentioned, there's people, you know, believing that parents are taking their kids to the doctor, telling the doctor to make their child transition, and the kid just comes out of the hospital like and completely different sex. Or like you said, the whole, oh, they're going to school, Jack, and coming back, Jill. You know, I've heard that one too. And then with trans athletes, mm-hmm. yeah, there's a lot of people who seem to believe that an AMAD person can just change their name and gender marker 2 weeks before a competition and start competing on the women's team or in the women's division, and like that's already not how it works. You're already required to go through HRT for at least a year before you're even allowed to compete in the women's division. So it's transphobes spewing a lot of propaganda and lies, like stuff that's just straight up not true, and that's what's driving them to target us, I think.
Well, it was always there. It also massively overestimates the number of people who are transgender in the first place and the number that will opt for any surgical intervention whatsoever. So it is it's a misnomer piled upon a misnomer. And then, but why is it so appealing to people to come after us? So in other words, what is it about us that is so innately threatening? And again, it's not just the binaries. It's the same reason why he refuses to call the Democratic Party the Democratic Party. They call it the Democrat Party. In other words, rather than describing the party, one is an adjective by saying it's the Democrat Party. He turns it into a noun and is more or less implying that these are aliens. These are the people that are the socialists. These are the, as he puts it in quotation marks, very bad people, very sick people. All the things that in point of fact his own followers are, he projects outwards onto other people. And this is the thing that's so absurd about it all.
So I just like to say there's, I'd like to turn the table around and celebrate our transgender athletes who have made it as far as the Olympics. And I just like to read a list of some of the transgender athletes who have participated in the Olympics in the last 4 years. Laurel Hubbard. I think we all remember Laurel Hubbard. She was the New Zealand weightlifter and the first openly transgender woman to compete in the Olympics. She was at Tokyo in 2020. And then there's Quinn. Quinn is a Canadian soccer player and was the first openly transgender and non-binary athlete to compete at the Olympics and win a medal. Quinn was playing for the Canadian soccer team. There's Chelsea Wolf, who went to the Olympics as an alternate on a BMX bicycle. And then there's Alana Smith. And Alana Smith is a United States skateboarder and the first openly non-binary athlete to represent the USA in the Olympics. That was at Tokyo in 2020. And a couple of other people that I think are just notable athletes that are worth noting. One is Chris Mosier. Chris Mosier is a trailblazing advocate for transgender athletes and the first known transgender man to make the men's U.S. national team. He also competed in the U.S. Olympic team trials in the 50K race walking event. And finally, everybody knows Leah Thomas. Leah Thomas is a college swimmer who's been a focal point in discussions about transgender athletes in sports. So those are some of our transgender athletes that I think we should celebrate and kind of turn the narrative. You know, I mean, it takes a lot of work to get to the Olympics, and these transgender people had the courage not only to come out and to be their authentic selves, but also worked really hard to get into the Olympics, and they did it. So that's that. Why don't we move on and talk about some other issues in the news? Does anybody have any other issues? Because if not,
Well, I know what the Kaiser story we were talking about. I definitely would like to address that at least. Do you want to talk about that, Emma?
Yeah, sure. Let me just pull that up. I'll just need a story from OPB, but it's also in a couple of other news sources. Kaiser Permanente, which is a really major insurance provider for health insurance here in the Pacific Northwest and on the West Coast, will no longer provide certain treatments for gender dysphoria at its hospitals and centers for patients under the age of 19. The pause is effective August 29th. So it says the decision, which was made at Kaiser's headquarters, applies to Kaiser facilities across the country, including Oregon and Washington. Kaiser officials cited the government's campaign against gender-affirming care, including DOJ-issued restrictions on funding and subpoenas, as a reason. Apparently, there's been efforts to subpoena doctors and clinics that provide gender-affirming care. Following the decision, attorney Dan Rayfield said he's going to work with providers to ensure they understand their rights under state law. So state law requires healthcare insurance to cover all treatment for gender dysphoria that's deemed medically necessary. So it sounds like Kaiser's in contradiction and conflicted between state law and federal law, because state law says that you're supposed to provide gender affirming care, and apparently now the federal government is saying that it's against the law. Well, they're saying it's against the executive order of Trump to provide gender affirming care, and so they think that's the law. So yeah, that's the news from Kaiser. Kaiser said it will still provide referrals to the extent that those services are available, but it doesn't say. See, according to, yeah, that's all I have. That's all the information I have on that. Basically, you know, they're doing the kibosh on gender affirming care for transgender teenagers. I mean, I'm not sure what else it's going to affect. It's going to definitely affect like access to medically necessary care.
I have some thoughts on it. We in a sense, it takes a very old transgender person to remember the way things used to be. The way that things used to be was that there was no support for transgender people through insurance. There was barely even medical recognition of the phenomenon. Any operations were considered cosmetic in nature, and therefore the number of places where you could have genital reassignment at one time, this is even before my day, was that you would have to go to places like Casablanca, you had to go to places like Tijuana. Then for many, many years, Dr. Stanley Biber out of Colorado became the primary place to go in America. And then there was a doctor, I believe, in Montreal, and there was someone in Belgium. And in other words, the standard of care that we think of now as normative was simply not present. So we're in a sense going back to those days. But we're also cannot go back to invisibility, which was the advantage. In those days, this was considered just a radically experimental, almost, it went through stages. Like for a little while, Johns Hopkins performed surgeries, and then a certain study was done that kind of dried up this Johns Hopkins program. And when Johns Hopkins was doing it, a lot of other universities started programs too. But when Johns Hopkins went out of the gender transition care business, so did many other places too. So we've watched all these permutations where one minute there's help and then sometimes there isn't. And as a kind of a postmodern philosopher who looks at gender and sometimes uses the language of social construction, we have to ask ourselves, what are we really talking about? What is transgender, and what does it mean when they cut off certain things and recognitions? The more threatening thing for me is not what they do to us surgically, because not everyone has surgery in the first place. What really is the question is whether gender variance in other areas of the behavior will be allowed. And that's why it's so important to have LGBT as one unit, because there is a gender component to different forms of being gay or being lesbian. So in some ways, all where we draw these lines is very hard to determine. But this effort to make certain people disappear by defining them out of existence, as if by signing some executive order he can make gender dysphoria disappear, is simply impossible. And the most appalling thing is this sleight of hand trick where they say, we're not against transgender people, we're only against people with gender dysphoria, because if they're dysphoric, they're going to ask us to pay for their surgeries, which is one of the primary reasons for firing people even after their post-surgical status in the armed forces. If they were really trying to save money, they'd say, well, maybe you were dysphoric, but now that you've had your surgery and are no longer reporting those symptoms, why do we need to fire you? But they do it anyway, because the basic thing is they don't want us around.
So a couple of things I'd just like to say about the specifics about Kaiser. So Kaiser, according to a couple of sources I saw, Kaiser is going to continue to prescribe puberty blockers and hormones for trans teens. So that's big. That's a big help. I'm glad to hear that. And they're going to continue offering mental health, family support, speech therapy, and workshops. But they are going to put a pause on any gender-affirming surgeries, including top surgeries. So I know that's going to be hard on some people. So that's kind of where it's at right now. Sorry, go ahead.
No, you can finish your sentence.
No, I'm done.
Okay. I was going to say, at least they're keeping puberty blockers, and I guess maybe HRT to some extent, because for a lot of trans youth, that is so, so important. I mean, a lot of gender dysphoria can be caused by just going through the wrong puberty. And in some cases, going through the wrong puberty is irreversible. And that's why it's so important to prevent the wrong puberty rather than just force the person to go through it, see if they even live through it without committing suicide. And then see if you can reverse the things about their body that they don't like after their body's already gone through those changes. And a lot of times it doesn't work as well as we'd like it to. So that's why, at the very least, I mean, so many people are like, well, why do kids need hormones before the age of 18? Why should kids transition before they're adults? Well, that's why you go through puberty younger than 18. And sometimes you need to prevent that in order to prevent suffering, not just in the present, but in the future, prevent lifetime suffering. Like, literally, puberty blockers are a lifesaver.
Well, we're getting near the end of the show. So I know that we wanted to talk about a little good news too. Does anyone have any good news?
I do. I mean, it's a very brief blurb because this was just announced, but Chapel Roan, who, if you don't know who she is a fairly famous pop singer right now, who is a lesbian and, you know, a big supporter of LGBT plus rights. And she's also been very vocal about supporting trans rights. And she recently announced that she's going on a mini US tour this year. And $1 from every ticket sold will be donated to trans youth charities.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, so that's good. That's something positive.
What does Chapel Row do?
Oh, I mean, like I said, she's a pop singer and songwriter. She's known for making a lot of music about her lesbian identity and relationships. She just this year won the Grammy for Best New Artist. If you haven't seen her performance at the Grammys where she performed Pink Pony Club, like that was a hell of a sight. I highly recommend checking it out. And just listening to her music in general. Like she's very talented. She has some great music, and I love that we have another LGBT icon. And also one who supports trans people, even though she's not trans herself. So, yeah, no, thank you. Go Chapel Roan.
Oh, great. Let's see. It looks like... So my bit of good news that I just like to kind of end with is that there are 16 state attorney generals who have got the moral courage to launch a joint legal fight for transgender health care. And this is from Aaron in the Morning. This came out yesterday. 16 attorney generals from across the country filed a landmark federal lawsuit on August 1st. And the legal battle could determine the fate of states' rights to uphold policies protecting transgender care. So that's really good news. This comes after the last 8 months have been flooded with anti-trans animus and policy and law, according to Aaron in the Morning. Since taking office on January 20th, the attorneys say that since taking office on January 20th, the president and his administration have relentlessly, cruelly, and unlawfully targeted transgender individuals. This has been a really great show. We've been listening to Transpositive, the podcast. And you can also find us on KBOO Community Radio. We play every other Tuesday at 6:30, at 6 p.m. On 90.7 FM, and also online. You can find us at kboo.fm/transpositive. So, Nicolette, Sheila, thanks so much for joining us tonight. Bedroom surprise.
Portland.
Sound was used for centuries as a method of torture. Place someone's head inside of a bell and ring it.